Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. Well, for me, it started as a tightness at the base of my throat and a feeling that was a combination of a need to cough and an internal kind of rapid flutter in my chest. It would only happen every few months for a few days before it cleared. Then this past fall, I woke up at 3:30 with a very rapid heartbeat that included a pause and a double beat, or what I call a flutter. I had no idea what was happening. My wife was out of town. I had three kids upstairs, and I'm thinking I might need to go to the hospital or even die. And kept thinking about my kids finding me the next morning. So after about 15 minutes of this without any relief, I did what any responsible person does, and I Googled rapid irregular heartbeat. I discovered that it was either AFib, VTAC, sinus tachycardia, or long QT syndrome, which of, you know, all of that meant nothing to me. So I did find something that I could do, which was they said I could reset my heart if I ran up and down the stairs for about 15 minutes. So I exercised a bit, and it did return to normal. Not all of the stories, however, end that way. Mine was good. And this led me, concerned for my history with my father's heart disease, led me to meet today's guest, Dr. John McDonough, a cardiologist with the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. Welcome to the show, Dr. McDonough. I appreciate you taking time to join me today.
Thank you very much, Prentice. It's my pleasure to be here.
Dr. McDonough graduated with a bachelor's degree in chemistry and biochemistry from Middlebury College in 1995. He attained his Doctor of Medicine from the University of Vermont in 2001 and completed his residency in 2005 at the University of Washington Residency Program, where he served as chief medical resident. Dr. McDonough then came north to work at the Central Peninsula General Hospital. He was there about 5 years and followed that with two fellowships in cardiovascular medicine and interventional cardiology. I need to remind listeners, you can reach us locally by calling us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. The last way to reach us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E. If you have a question about your heart or an experience you want to share, please call in early with your questions or comments, and we can get you on the air with Dr. McDonough. Having a real cardiologist at our disposal for an hour, it's way better than Google. So give us a call, and hopefully he'll answer your questions and or at least guide you in the direction of where you might look. So, all right, that leads us to really my first question. I want to get a little bit more about your specific expertise in areas of where your focus is in your practice.
Great. So, as you mentioned, I trained in internal medicine first, which I practiced as a primary care physician for a number of years down in Soldotna. And then my family and I decided to go back for more training, and we moved to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where I did 3 years of training in cardiovascular medicine, and then another year to further subspecialize in interventional cardiology. That's a specialty that most people are probably familiar with as somebody who puts in stents in the heart, and we do a few other activities too, such as treat blocked arteries in the legs in particular, or sometimes in the arms, and also now have the ability to treat structural problems of the heart, most commonly aortic valve stenosis or a blocked valve, blocked aortic valve, which can now sometimes be treated by a catheter-based procedure instead of open heart surgery.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about different types of heart disease and different types of both, I guess, the electrical, the plumbing, and the structural parts of the heart. Can you talk a little bit about these three areas and how they kind of blend together?
Yeah, of course. You know, throughout medical training, you learn that pretty much anything that is built or functions in the body can have something go wrong with it. The heart is a fascinating and complex organ, and ultimately it's a pump that pumps blood to the rest of the body. To make that happen effectively, the pumping muscle needs to work correctly, the valves need to work correctly, the electrical system that controls the pump needs to work correctly, and the supply of blood to the heart itself needs to work correctly. And so we see problems with all of those mechanisms being disrupted. And so that leads to rhythm problems, like atrial fibrillation would be one of the more common rhythm problems. Coronary heart disease, which is one of the number one causes of death in the United States, is a problem where the small heart arteries, also known as the coronary arteries, which are about 2 to 4 millimeters in width, become plugged with cholesterol plaque and blood clot sometimes. And that's what causes heart attacks and chest pain. And then we see things with the valves failing and the pump failing, leading to failure of the heart. Yeah.
So there's all three things working together in concert to form a system. I read that the heart beats, average heartbeat is 2.5 billion times in a lifetime. I mean, that's an incredible number, and the amount of blood that the heart pushes through the body, I forget the number, but it's millions of gallons of blood through the body. It's amazing that it can go for 80 years at that with all the stuff that has to go on. It truly
is amazing. I mean, it has to pump about 5 liters a minute for your entire life. And, you know, if you had to do that with your biceps, you wouldn't make it. But luckily, we've been blessed with a heart that is able to just beat over and over and over again.
Yet one third of all deaths approximately are caused by heart disease.
Yeah, that's right. So cardiovascular disease remains, unfortunately, the number one. When you group all cardiovascular diseases together, that remains the number one cause of death and disability in the United States. That number has statistically gone down over time, somewhat to the point where we're about even with cancer as the cause of death. But I think, as I recall, we're still number one.
Okay, not something
to be proud of.
It's not a victory. You'd like to move down that list, obviously.
Obviously.
All right. So before we get into the meat of this, let's, common question. So many people have a heart murmur or a palpitation or a flutter, or it seems really common. You talk to people. I was talking to people about my experience, and my brother is probably in the dentist chair listening to this right now, I think, who I was talking to him last night, and I said I saw Dr. McDonough. He's like, that's the same guy I saw. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, I remembered it because that's the name of our pediatrician when we were growing up in Atlanta.
That's funny.
It is. With all the guys that you have over there, what's the chances of that? But there's a lot of people that have this sort of sensation, and it creates a lot of fear, but some of them are really kind of benign. So what's the difference? Flutter, palpitation, murmur?
Yeah. So when I see patients in the office, it's very common for people to say, oh, I've been, you know, I've had a heart murmur ever since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And a heart murmur is, by definition, a sound that your heart makes when it beats. And it refers to the sound of flow of blood through the heart. And that can be related to an abnormal problem with one of the heart valves. That's the thing that we're looking for a lot. I will say that even though I have a very nice stethoscope, when people say that they were told that they've had a heart murmur, about half the time do I actually hear a murmur.
Hmm.
And most commonly, murmurs of childhood are just the fact that somebody was able to hear the blood flow through the heart at one point. Once in a while, they may reflect a subtle or not so subtle problem, particularly with one of the heart valves, and that's one reason to, you know, to check it out. But
how's that different than a palpitation then?
So palpitation, by definition, is just simply the awareness of one's own heart beating. So that means you feel your heart beat, and that may mean you feel a skip beat, or that you feel a series of rapid beats, or you feel a series of slow heartbeats, or you just feel it beating strongly, which sometimes happens. So if you run up the stairs and your heart is pounding and you can feel that in your chest, that technically speaking would be a palpitation.
But some palpitations are arrhythmias.
True. So, you know, just like a heart murmur, most of the time when people say they feel their heart beating, it's often related to a fairly benign condition. But rarely, or sometimes not so rarely, depending on the situation, their symptoms may reflect a more concerning rhythm disturbance of the heart.
All right, so palpitations are worth getting looked at. I guess let's go ahead. We got a first call, so let's go ahead and take Richard. You're on the air with Dr. McDonough. Go ahead.
Hello. First of all, good to hear you went to University of Vermont. I did as well, so go Cats, go.
Thank you.
I'm diagnosed with HCM, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, in using a general term. There's some debate. I've heard more than one opinion on whether or not alcohol is okay to imbibe. And then I had a second question, which was about exercise levels. I've seen charts where it'll show different kinds of exercise rated at like a 4, and that's, you're not supposed to do 4s, like hockey, basketball, or something, bucks, I don't know. But you can do things like biking, which is like a 1, or jogging. So those are my questions about alcohol and exercise with HCM.
All right. Thank you for the call, Richard. I appreciate it. Dr. McDonough, you want to take it away?
Those are really good questions, and I'm thankful that the caller brought up hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So for the listeners who aren't sure what that means, the term hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, generally speaking, refers to an inherited or genetically based condition where the heart muscle is thickened and is abnormal. And by abnormal, I mean usually contains some level of scar tissue within the heart. And the predisposition for this is thought in most cases to be related to, like as I mentioned, a genetic condition. Some people may be familiar with the case of Lynn Bias or other athletes who died suddenly, even though they appear to be in the prime of their life. And in those situations, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy was one potential cause of sudden death if it was unrecognized and untreated.
Okay.
There is quite a variation in how people experience these sort of group of conditions, I would say. Some people are very minimally symptomatic, and some people have severe symptoms to the point where even rarely need heart transplantation. The caller's questions are good. I get those questions a lot with respect to all sorts of heart disease about alcohol and exercise. I usually don't feel like I'm in a good position to recommend that people drink alcohol as a physician for a lot of health reasons, but there is observational data that mild to moderate alcohol consumption is associated with a lower risk of heart attack and stroke. I'm not aware personally of any reason why 1 to 2 alcoholic beverages would be particularly harmful for most people with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. That said, there may be certain specific circumstances where especially a patient with severe symptoms related to that might not tolerate that. So that's something I would, in your specific case, would ask your cardiologist about. Exercise is also a really good question. It has previously been worried that a lot of exercise may actually make the cardiac hypertrophy and scar tissue formation within the heart worse. On the other hand, we know that there's lots of really good benefits to exercise, especially moderate intensity exercise, such as walking briskly or light jogging or bike riding. And actually, it's funny you mentioned this. One of my colleagues where I trained at the University of Michigan recently presented at our national meeting just yesterday a randomized trial of exercise in patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and found that there was probably reasonable benefit to exercise and very little concern for cause for harm. So I think, again, I would ask your cardiologist in your specific situation what's going on. But in general, I think at least moderate regular exercise is probably more beneficial than not.
So in the other piece of Richard's question, high intensity exercises might be out.
That's a tough one. And I guess I would defer to my colleagues who are experts in this. But in general, I would be a little bit worried about high intensity exercise as a blanket recommendation for patients with this condition.
And that's because of the stress that that puts on when you maximize the effort, the output of the heart. It can go beyond what it's capable of doing at that point.
Theoretically, there you might promote a situation of hemodynamic instability.
Which is?
So that's a good question. So, and again, it would really relate specifically to each individual case, I think. But for example, the case of the most striking case being somebody like Lynn Bias, the Celtics basketball player who died suddenly.
That was tragic. That was tough.
There are situations like that where that possibly could occur with really high intensity exercise.
And you hear about that in young, like, is that like the 12 or 14 year old baseball player who dies doing sprints? That kind of thing. There's some underlying genetic, which leads us right into another call. We have Ben. You're on the air with Dr. McDonough. You have a question about genetics.
Yeah. So my dad had his first heart attack around 50. Well, he's the first one that put him into a hospital, and his result was a handful of stents. His father had a handful of heart attacks. I want to say maybe a dozen or so. The first one that hospitalized him was at 55 and ended up with a four-way bypass and a handful of other issues. So I'm 35. I get occasional pinching right where I think my heart should be. But I'm wondering what I should be doing proactively to make sure that my heart's healthy, and if there's any kind of testing or anything I should be doing to make sure that I'm taking care of this ticker so I don't beat the record and go for one under 50.
That's a great question. I'm really glad you called. Is he still on the line or no?
Yeah. I think so.
Was your father or grandfather smokers at all?
Dad was until the first big heart attack, and Grandpa was until he got out of the Navy.
Okay. And I'm assuming you probably don't smoke cigarettes.
I have on and off for about 5 years. Yeah. Not a lifelong thing or anything, but on and off for 5 years.
So family history is an incredibly important risk factor for coronary disease, and especially in the population data, having a first degree family member, so that's either a parent or a sibling who had their first coronary event, such as a heart attack, stent, or bypass surgery, or under the age of 50. For a man, or I think 55 for a woman, that's an important risk factor. And so for somebody like you, I think it's great you're calling at age 35 because you have an incredible opportunity to prevent significant heart disease. We know a lot more now about prevention than we did when your father was a kid or when your grandfather was a kid. By not smoking, you can... or using tobacco products in general, you can cut your risk in half. So that's number one. I would definitely check your cholesterol levels. A lot of people who have a family history of earlier aggressive coronary heart disease have a familial hyperlipidemia, meaning an inherited very high cholesterol levels. And for you, I would actually recommend, regardless of your cholesterol levels, probably a pretty intensive dietary regimen that is mostly plant-based, has very little sugar, very little animal fat. And if you had particularly high cholesterol, I would probably recommend treating you with a cholesterol medication. And I think if you do all those things, you can substantially reduce your risk of heart attack and stroke.
Okay, I really appreciate the help. Yeah. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah. Of course.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ben. for those of you who might be tuning in late, my guest today is Anchorage cardiologist Dr. John McDonough. On today's program, we are discussing the prevention and treatment of common heart problems. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number. That's 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Last way to reach us is you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. Before the calls, we were kind of getting into some arrhythmia questions, but I did have a follow-up question.
Of course.
You mentioned the risk is cut in half by not using tobacco products. Well, how long does that take? Like, say you're a 10, 20-year smoker,
Great.
And then you stop.
Yeah.
How long? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years before your risk is cut? And when do you become like a normal person?
That's a really good question.
A regular level risk.
Yeah. So there are a couple things about smoke. Even secondhand smoke is a risk factor for what we call an acute coronary syndrome. That would be a heart attack or kind of a minor heart attack or a stroke. Just as an example, there's been many studies that have been done like this. In about 10 years ago, in Helena, Montana, they studied the rate of acute heart attacks in the town before and after the institution of a smoking ban in public places like bars and restaurants and so forth. One of the reasons why it was a cool study is that being a relatively geographically isolated place, there weren't a lot of people coming and going, especially because it was the middle of winter when the ban went in effect, and they saw an overnight reduction of 50% in the rate of heart attacks in that town.
Wow.
So even one breath full of cigarette smoke supercharges the platelets in your blood, which are the cells that are responsible for forming blood clots. And as we used to joke, it scratches your endothelium. That's the lining of the arteries. A happy endothelium is smooth and free of inflammation, whereas people who get heart attacks have an inflamed, irritated endothelium, so to speak. And so your question about how long does it take to return to baseline risk, there is some data on that, and I confess I can't remember exactly, but my loose understanding is that after few years of not smoking cigarettes, your risk of a heart attack or an acute coronary syndrome returns more or less to baseline. So it can have a substantial impact to quit smoking. It is never too late to quit. That's for sure.
That's the same message I got from Dr. Chung in a lung cancer show. It's never too late to quit.
Absolutely.
So the initial reduction in risk is pretty quick.
Yeah.
And then a return to baseline within 3-4 years.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. I got another caller. It's Diet and Secondhand Smoke. Don, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. You're right on target. We're in the same thought pattern today.
Yeah.
About time I think of something, you're speaking about it on the radio. I have a problem occasionally driving people around town and whatnot. I'm 75, and I had a nasty one when I was 53.
Uh-huh.
And it turned me off to smoking. I had smoked for like 4 decades, and not real heavy, but you know, a pack or so a day. But I gave it all up, and I got the situation squared off, and I still run into people once in a while, despite the fact they've been repeatedly warned and told, you know, if you're going to ride in my car, you don't smoke.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple of them where I just had to pull the car over, stop, get out, because I've you try, you be polite as you can, but if you get them to say, look, take a cloth and go clean my windows on my car on the inside, and you see all the crud that comes from the nicotine sulfate. That's the same stuff that builds up in your lungs, arteries, whatever. And they still can't seem to get that through their head that it affects your body that way. They know, for example, if you take and blow the smoke through a T-shirt, it leaves a stain on a shirt.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing, you know, we've known about this for decades, and we tend to ignore it. And, well, it's my body, I'll do what I want. Well, fine, but what about the people around you? And that is, as just got pointed out by your
right
set up there, and where was that, Montana or whatever?
Right, that's just one example. Yeah.
Splendid example. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
we don't.
But I've done clean, and I really haven't missed it from that standpoint. My problem that I've got, the doctors repeatedly keep telling me, is leg veins. You watch your leg veins. You know, stay away from the fatty meat and stuff. Stay with your fish and chicken.
Yeah.
And keep a handle on a diet. And as one who's, I guess they call it pre-diabetic now, borderline is what they used to call it, try to keep a little bit of sugar in your diet without going overboard.
Right.
Big weakness I had to watch out for was soda pop.
Yeah, soda's
a
tough one.
I had no problem controlling the alcohol and the drinking. I'm from a moderate family when it comes to that use. But the sugar is something else, and my understanding, if whatever is true, what I've been hearing is that sugar is probably the most addictive substance known to man for all animals. So I think I picked that up on one of your programs a while back. But yes, sir, I appreciate your efforts and your work, and the only thing I can tell people is get the advice. And at least give it a good, serious try before you snub it.
All right, Don. Thanks a lot for the call. Those are some great points.
Very much. Love your shows.
Appreciate you. Can you speak real quickly to sugar? My dad's doctor once told him, he said, Bruce, do you want to live? And he said, yeah. And he said, well, you should stop eating sugar because it's poison. That's what he told him.
There's a lot there. One thing I'll say about dietary advice and recommendations is that if you get online and try to figure out what a healthy diet is to eat and then try to follow every single possible recommendation that you find, you will soon find yourself not eating anything. So it's
certainly not enjoying it.
Yeah. It's tough. You know, I think, you know, both you and the caller brought up sugar, and there has been emerging within the last few years more science and more, I think, popular attention to sugar and the fact that there is so much of it available in our food. And there's, I think, reasonable concern that it's probably not healthy to eat refined sugar all that often. How much is okay and how strictly one should avoid it, I think, is up for a lot of debate. And I'm not sure that I'm the best person prepared to debate that. But I, generally speaking, recommend to my patients to avoid a lot of refined sugar and a lot of carbohydrates. Most people don't need to eat potatoes or a lot of bread, frankly, unless they're really running marathons, you know, daily, which they're not. So,
because that stuff is turned into sugar.
Yeah, I mean, it's immediately stored in your body as sugar. And you know, there's a lot of extra calories and weight gain, and actually ultimately cholesterol and lipid problems are promoted by an insulin, too much insulin in your body, which in turn is promoted by too much carbohydrate or starch or sugar intake.
Yeah. My foods of choice, pizza, bacon, cheeseburgers, and french fries are not good, is what you're saying.
I love pizza just as much as the next guy, but I try to only eat it about once a month.
It's a special occasion food.
Yeah.
We're almost at the break, but Rose has been on hold for a while. She's got a question about heart palpitations. You're on the air with Dr. McDonough. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My husband's 39. He's been having ongoing heart palpitations. He's had he just completed the 30-day heart monitor. He also had the sonogram, which said everything physically is fine with his heart. And we haven't come to any findings on why he's having the kind of the palpitations. It'll skip a beat and it'll make him cough a little bit, but he's not hot today.
Is he having sustained beats, or is it just happening for a split second and then going away?
It'll happen, go away, then some days he'll maybe have one episode, and then other days, like today, it'll be like several, one after the other.
Yeah. So let me first say that that symptom is extremely common, you know, in a day of seeing clinic patients, you know, maybe I'll see 15 to 20 people, and almost a third of them can be there because of those symptoms. And it is concerning. I will say that palpitations, the symptom of palpitations happens more frequently as we get older. It happens, seems to happen more frequently, just speaking from personal experience, when you get sleep deprived, often perhaps related to having kids at home or too much work-life stress. They're not always, just because they're happening more frequently, it doesn't always mean that there's something pathologic going on with the heart. And the most common explanation that we see on those event monitors, you mentioned your husband was wearing a 30-day cardiac event monitor, which is basically a way of recording every heartbeat that you have for a month. The most common thing that we find on those are what are called ectopic heartbeats. So instead of the heartbeat arising from the normal sinus mechanism of the heart, where the sinus node, or the essentially the heart's intrinsic pacemaker, sends out its normal regular heartbeat, other parts of the heart, either from the top chambers, the atria, or the bottom chambers, the ventricles, can toss in extra heartbeats, and people feel those. And sometimes they don't feel them, and sometimes they do. And once in a while, those ectopic beats can trigger other arrhythmias as well. When I see folks for this condition, you know, the first thing I try to do is sort out, is this a person who has an underlying more serious, perhaps more rare, but more serious heart condition? And the ultrasound of the heart can be quite helpful there, because it excludes a lot of bad things. And so the fact that his is normal is very reassuring. And then the question is how much are these happening, and how much is it worth kind of pursuing, you know? If he's not fainting, and he's not having chest pain, and he's not having major shortness of breath, those are all good things too. It's kind of like what I worked on with our host, you know, Prentice. Is very similar. You know, we arrived at a situation where we kind of figured out what was going on and decided that it was okay to have a little bit of what was going on and not get too worked up about it. So I don't know. I think he's doing all the right things. And I think if you're trying to uncover and make sure that he doesn't have the bad things, then that's mostly pretty reassuring.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Rose. Well, thank you for the call. I appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much.
All right. I want to come back to that, but and add a little bit more to Rose's question. But we're at the halfway point of our show right now, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is cardiologist Dr. John McDonough. On today's program, we are discussing the prevention and treatment of common heart problems. If you have a question for Dr. McDonough or a comment about today's topic, our local number is 550-8433, or you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is to email us your question to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. McDonough. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Anchorage cardiologist Dr. John McDonough. On today's program, we're discussing the prevention and treatment of common heart problems. Remember, you can email your questions or comments about today's topic to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us on our local number at 550-8433 or reach us toll-free from anywhere at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8 p.m., so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we won't be able to accept phone calls, obviously. Okay, before the break, Rose had called and was talking about her husband's heart palpitations, which sounded a little bit more like arrhythmias, or I know for sure, I mean, when she was talking, it was just sort of paralleling my situation where I had these sort of flutters, or and they would last anywhere from seconds to sometimes they'd come and go and for a week or so, and then they'd go away. And I had one recently before I went on vacation, and when I did go on vacation, they went away. My brother has similar symptoms. I don't know if genetics play a part in that, but as you were saying, we sort of eliminated the big ones, and I wasn't having any other symptoms. I wasn't fainting. I wasn't having any pain. I wasn't having any other symptoms other than just this sort of weird kind of feeling that made me want to cough a little bit. And can you talk a little bit about why? I mean, I was asking you, like, right. I was scared, and I'm saying this, and you're like, well, you know, like, you're good. Like, I said, well, are there things I should avoid, like strenuous exercise? Am I going to explode my heart? And you're like, nah, like, I mean, what's the probability stuff? And, you know, right. If you go chasing every little thing, you can find yourself just running around in circles and getting super stressed out. So,
yeah.
Speak a little bit about, like, a little bit more about what I was kind of dealing with. I think it paralleled really well.
So I think in patients who experience symptoms of a potential arrhythmia, the first concern is there a substrate, meaning is this a person who's at risk for a malignant arrhythmia or something that could cause them to die? And that is usually related to somebody who has an abnormal heart in some way, either because they maybe had a large heart attack previously or have a significant valvular abnormality, or as the other caller mentioned, has hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or some inherited condition of the heart. The people with abnormal hearts tend to have a higher risk of more concerning abnormal rhythms. You can have significant abnormal rhythms and have a normal heart, although it's less common. I know that my electrophysiology colleagues, the doctors who specialize in the electrical problems of the heart, can speak to this even more definitively than I can. But there is a certain sort of weighing of the risks that a physician does, or I do, when I see somebody with these symptoms. And the other things that really play into it are there associated symptoms, like did the person faint or feel like they were about to faint? Did they see stars when this happened? Did they have crushing chest pain? Did they feel really short of breath? Because those things make a big difference in how I think about these rhythm problems. And as I was mentioning to you before the show, like I have a tachycardia myself, and my heart goes 200 beats per minute. It kicks in and out of it. It only lasts for maybe 20 or 30 seconds, and I'm able to get out of it with what's called a Valsalva maneuver, where I just bear down and it goes away.
What is that? What do you mean bear down and it goes away?
So a Valsalva maneuver is simply a way of triggering your own what's called your vagus nerve, or the part of your autonomic nervous system that causes your heart to slow down. And the typical maneuver would be to take a breath in and really bear down on your stomach as if you were, you know, for lack of a less graphic term, trying to have a bowel movement or something like that.
Okay.
But essentially increasing the pressure inside your chest for a few seconds. And that is actually an effective way for terminating some of these arrhythmias. And
interesting.
Yeah.
The vagus nerve is in the gut, is it not?
It goes from the brain down to the gut. That's right.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. And that is involved with the rhythm of your heart somehow.
The sinus node, which controls your heart rate, is responsive to stimulation of the vagus nerve. So just like it's responsive to circulating epinephrine or adrenaline, so when you're being chased by the saber-toothed tiger or running from an avalanche, your heart rate picks up a little bit. When you've had a big meal and are laying down in your cave or your house, afterwards, it slows down.
The vagus nerve is an important guy.
Very much. Yeah.
All right. We've got some phone calls, so we're going to go ahead and get back to those. So I'll go with Melody. You're on the air with Dr. McDonough. Go ahead.
Hello. It's wonderful to have a cardiologist on. My brother is 60 years old. He has PVCs, a mitral valve prolapse, and a heart murmur.
Okay.
And actually, it has a heart murmur. Our mother passed at 63 from a sudden heart attack. This is after she had triple bypass surgery, 2 carotid endarterectomies.
Oh, wow.
He had but nobody else in our family, and she had adult onset diabetes. No one else in our family has had diabetes. I know it's supposed to be hereditary, but in any case, he freaked all of us out 2 months ago. And he had had all kinds of tests done, and every time they have to go for any sort of procedures, if they do an EKG, everybody gets all excited.
Sure.
Are PVCs just common and normal?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so when I hear somebody has PVCs and... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
She's just hit the phone, I think.
Okay. I'm listening.
PVCs?
So PVC stands for premature ventricular contraction.
Okay.
They can also be known as ectopic ventricular beats or a couple of different terms, but essentially what they are extra heartbeats that are usually inserted into the normal cardiac cycle and temporarily interrupt it for one cycle. So
another type of arrhythmia, essentially.
Yeah.
Those arrhythmias are all over.
They're all over. Almost everybody has some PVCs. So the question is, you can have PVCs and then you can have a lot of PVCs. And some people do have a lot of PVCs, you know, and they can make up about a third or a quarter or even more of all the heartbeats. And there is a point at which people tend to not tolerate them, and everybody's a little bit different. But most people with PVCs are asymptomatic. And so they don't necessarily mean by themselves that there's a significant problem. But if I was your brother's cardiologist, I would want to know, well, how much is he happening? Are they really causing symptoms and that kind of stuff? And the same goes for the mitral valve prolapse. There's little bits of prolapse, and then there's severe prolapse with a very leaky mitral valve. And those are two different, ends of the spectrum. And it's important to really to know where you're at. It's easy to label people in cardiology. We're so good at our diagnostic tests. We can detect PVCs and a little bit of prolapse, and all of a sudden a person who thought they had a totally normal heart still now has 2 diagnoses. But, you know, depending on how bad those are, they may or may not be all that clinically meaningful in the person outcome of the person's life. So it's a good question.
Well, he's a white male, and he won't go to a doctor unless he absolutely has to. And his solution was to cut back on how much peanut butter he ate. And so I wondered if you had more constructive things to say to him.
That sounds very like Alaskan male. I don't want to, I'm not going to the doctor. Like, and that's something we were talking about earlier before the show, is this in Alaska, there is a high incidence of people waiting and waiting and waiting and then getting into some serious trouble.
That's absolutely true. And from where I sit, even though coronary heart disease is a number one killer, a lot of coronary heart disease is absolutely preventable. You can never prevent everything 100%, but, you know, your mother's family, you know, you have a family history with your mother that's somewhat concerning. And I think it's important for anybody as they approach middle age in particular, or younger, if they have a strong family history, to kind of subject themselves to a comprehensive risk assessment of developing coronary heart disease.
you define comprehensive risk assessment and by whom?
Yeah, so either a physician can help with that, or, you know, some people are sophisticated enough, they're able to kind of do it on their own with online stuff. But, you know, at minimum, it involves an assessment of family history, of dietary history, of smoking, of diabetes or pre-diabetes, and of cholesterol levels. And, you know, if you go through all that stuff and then also think about what you can do to improve diet and exercise, you can assess your risk and then start doing things to mitigate your risk.
Okay.
Yeah. So
thank you very much.
I don't think he needs to go to a doctor every 3 months because of these conditions, but I think seeing somebody once and, you know, just asking an honest question, what's my risk of having a heart attack, is a reasonable thing. And what can I do to prevent it?
Sister Ever, thank you. Yeah.
All right, thanks for the call, Melody. Let's keep going with the phone calls. Ken, you're on with Dr. McDonough. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. How you doing? I guess I have a two-part question. I'm 71. I'm pretty high-intense workouts, pretty darn good shape. And every so often I get like a stomach or abdominal spasm, and it seems to throw the heartbeat off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a second or two, and I do have a problem at times with hydration and cramping because I work out so much, trying to stay on top of that. But the second part of the question is, does potassium have something to do with that, or I should say lack of potassium?
Yeah, good questions. One thing I want to mention is that exercise is incredibly beneficial, so I think working out a lot is good. There's science that says that moderate intensity exercise of up to about 5 hours a week, or light intensity exercise of up to about 8 or 9 hours a week. So that means walking for 9 hours a week, or going for a run or a jog or something equivalent for up to 5 hours a week, significantly reduces your risk of having a heart attack. That said, people who are in great shape can have heart attacks. It's all about risk assessment.
Jim Fix.
Jim Fix is a classic example for people who don't know who he was. He was in the 1980s.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Famous. He wrote a book about running yourself to health, and he was jogging all over, I think, New England and across the country, and sort of had a health movement. And then he was found dead on the side of the road because he had a strong family history and probably a familial hypercholesterolemia, inherited high cholesterol, that led him to have kind of early and aggressive coronary disease. And I've taken care of mountaineers and cross-country skiers who have had heart attacks, but I will say it's a lot less common than smokers and people with poor diet. So exercise is important. It's hard to know exactly what the caller is experiencing. It sounds like he may be having like a PVC or something like that that's perhaps triggered by muscle spasm or something. But I don't know. You know, things that I look for in terms of worrying about concerning symptoms in the chest are, you know, sustained episodes of chest pressure that are particularly worse with exertion, things like that. Potassium, he brought up the question of, go ahead.
Oh. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I never experienced that, you know, during workouts.
Or, yeah.
And it's not a consistent thing. It's not, you know, if it happens,
yeah,
if it happens a couple of 2-3 times a month at the most.
Sure.
But when it does, you know, I don't want to say frightening. It's just, you know, you don't pay attention. You don't think about your heart. And then all of a sudden,
you feel
a weird thing and you go, wow, what was that, you know?
Right. And I hesitate always, you know, to give too much specific advice without meeting you or examining you, right? But it is, I will say that generally speaking, it is common for people to experience occasional ectopic heartbeats that give them a sense that their heart is either skipping a beat or stopping for a second. And they are not always a problem. That's what I would say.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ken. Got to move on. Appreciate it. Okay, if you're just tuning in, my guest today is Anchorage cardiologist Dr. Jonathan, or John McDonough. It's the first time I messed it up. On today's program, we're discussing the prevention and treatment of common heart problems. It's getting pretty late, but our phone numbers are 550-8433 or toll-free 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. I have a bunch of emails. I don't think we're going to get through them all, but I do want to read one that's interesting. I've heard of a link between several STDs, primarily HSV and HPV, that have direct correlation with the risk of heart disease. Are these risks lowered by taking immunosuppressant medication, or does the lack of vitamin D at high latitudes cause enough immunosuppression to reduce risk? I don't know what that question's about. Do you?
So I don't have a great answer for the question, although it certainly is interesting and is a very sophisticated question. It's probably handled best by an epidemiologist. But in general, conditions that cause inflammation of the or upticking in the immune system have been associated with slight increases in the risk of developing cardiovascular disease. The extrapolation to does vitamin D insufficiency lead to a downregulation of the immune system that there would by protects you from whatever increase in immune activity you would have from that? I can't answer that question.
Okay.
There is vitamin D is always in the news. There's a concern that too little vitamin D is associated with all sorts of problems, including problems with the immune system and perhaps cardiovascular disease.
Depression. Yeah.
There is also a concern that too much vitamin D might lead to more heart disease in the long run due to its effects on calcium metabolism. So I'm going to take a pass on that one.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Here's another email. Can you speak about the difference in having a stent versus a coronary artery bypass?
Great question. So in treating coronary artery blockages, if the symptoms or presentation become severe or acute enough, then what cardiologists describe as revascularization, so restoring blood flow to the affected parts of the heart, is warranted. And the two main mechanisms for doing that are either through stents, which are essentially the insertion of metal mesh scaffolds into the artery, which are expanded to relieve the obstructions, versus open heart surgery to perform bypass, which usually involves taking either veins from the leg and or an artery from the inside of the chest wall and tacking it onto the heart downstream of the obstruction to restore blood flow that way. Both have a critical and essential role. There are specific circumstances that are probably better handled by stents, and there are specific circumstances that are handled better by bypass surgery. And part of it has to do with the number of blockages one has, some of the technical features of those blockages, where they're located within the heart. One area in particular that people like myself, interventional cardiologists, worry about are blockages of what's called the left main coronary artery. So that is on the artery that goes to the left side of the heart and then splits into two major arteries. The one that comes down to the front of the heart, and then one that reaches around to the back and the side of the heart, and in total supplies at least 2/3 to 3/4 of all the heart muscle. If there's a blockage involving where that artery splits, we often feel that bypass surgery is better, because stents in that area, if there were to be a problem with the stent, would be pretty catastrophic. That said, there are certain circumstances where stents work fine there too. So each situation needs to be handled and adjudicated carefully, and we work closely with our cardiac surgery colleagues to figure out what the best treatment strategy is.
Okay. Yeah. We're getting running out of time, but we got one more caller I want to go ahead and take. Is it Tressa or Teresa? What, you're on the air.
It's Tressa.
Tressa, okay.
Hi, Tressa. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Hello. I'm 28 years old, no history of heart issues in my family or me, but in probably since it's the worst of it was about October, November of last year, I started having symptoms where I can't catch my breath, I have heart palpitations, chest pains really bad, I would get to where I'd pass out here and there almost, And I found out I was anemic. They don't know if that's what's causing all of it.
Sure.
I'm supposed to get a echo stress test, but they want my levels to come up a little bit. So I just didn't know if you had any more ideas on that or what. My EKGs are coming back abnormal, and I've never had that before.
Well, I'm glad you're getting evaluated. It sounds like you're having some, you know, potentially concerning symptoms. And if I was your physician, I'd want to know how anemic were you. I'd examine you real carefully to figure out if there's potentially anything else going on. And one of the hard things that I face is that symptoms of lightheadedness and fatigue and shortness of breath can be related to so many different parts of the body, including the lungs, the heart, the anemia, as you pointed out. But it's important to really try and pin it down. And so just because you're 28 doesn't mean you can't have some form of heart disease, although it's less common at your age, but it can happen. And I guess I would want to know what your EKG showed. And I'd, you know, if we weren't getting to the bottom of it, I would go down the road of getting more specific cardiac testing probably.
Okay, good.
I don't know if that's
on the road that we're on. I just want to make sure they just keep pushing it off, kind of. And I'm like, no, I just want it done now.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and obviously you're concerned about it. I think it's reasonable to pursue some evaluation, and you may find that everything's fine with your heart, which would be great news.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for the call.
I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Tressa.
Thank you.
Okay, you got about 45 seconds to talk about the importance of early detection of heart attack risk.
That's not a lot of time, but I will say that in Alaska, given our geography, we see a lot of what we call late presentations of heart attacks. You know, people have been putting it off for a couple of days, or because of geography, just can't get in to a doctor for a day or two, and they've been having symptoms. And I guess I just want to make a public, service announcement that if you're worried, or you've got risk factors, or you haven't had cardiovascular risk assessed, that it's reasonable and recommended to at least talk to your primary care physician about these things and try to do everything you can to prevent heart attacks, because when it's been going on for a couple of days and the heart muscle is already dead, it's really hard to... It's hard to salvage that situation sometimes. Heart attacks can have all sorts of symptoms, from chest pain to chest pressure to acute shortness of breath, and how you tell it different from heartburn or just gastroesophageal reflux can be a challenge, but it's worth looking into.
All right, so talk about it and get it checked out. Thanks, Dr. McDonough, for joining us today. All right. If you want to continue today's conversation, you can find KSK on Facebook at alaskapublic.org. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said the courts of this country should not be places where resolution of dispute begins. They should be places where the disputes end after alternative methods of resolving disputes have been considered and tried. Next week on Line One, two Anchorage mediators join me to discuss conflict and the art of dispute resolution. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, March 27th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA Anchorage. Dave Waldron was our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to listen. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.